Lecture 16, The Beginning of the New Kingdom, The Fabulous 18th Dynasty.
Hello again. Remember last time we took a little bit of a side trip? We talked about the Joseph story and could they have been the Hyksos. What I'd like to do today is get us back on track chronologically, trying to trace the history of Egypt from the beginning to the end. Now, go back two lectures ago in your mind when we talked about the Hyksos who were expelled, right, kicked out of Egypt finally by Amos. Now, that's where I want to pick up our story of Egypt's history, with Amos, who begins the 18th dynasty. It's a period that is the glory years of ancient Egypt. It's the one that contains the pharaoh Tutankhamun, Thutmose III, the queen Hatshepsut. A lot of the famous kings of Egypt, kings and queens, are in the 18th dynasty, and this is the period that establishes that greatness. Now, we'll see four trends today. One is we'll see that this dynasty, right at the beginning, establishes the importance of women. Queens are very important in Egypt. Another thing we'll see is that they increase the use of a standing army to bring back tribute and increase the wealth of Egypt. Another innovation that will stay with us for quite a while is they begin burial in the Valley of the Kings. We'll also have a chance to look at Thebes being really established as the capital of Egypt. There'll really be two capitals, Memphis in the north and Thebes in the south as a religious capital. But Thebes really gets established during this time. And we'll have a little time to look at what's it like to be a military man in ancient Egypt. So those are the four things we'll try to do. And let's try to do them. Let me say something about Amos. Remember, he's the one whose father, Sekhenenre, was killed, that grisly mummy that was smashed to bits in the battle with Apophis, the Hyksos king. Amos is the one who finally kicks out the Hyksos. Well, he does a couple of interesting things when he becomes king by himself, right? He's the first king of Dynasty 18. First thing he does is he honors his grandmother and his mother. He erects monuments to them. Now, his grandmother is Sekhenenre's mother, right? And his mother is Sekhenenre's wife, right? So he's of an Egyptian queen, right? How many can you think of? Maybe two, three, right? You got Nefertiti's pretty famous, Cleopatra, maybe Hatshepsut, right? Now, try to think of a Greek queen. It's harder. The reason is that women were important in Egypt, but not in Greece. In Greece, a woman, even a queen, couldn't even inherit by herself. She had to inherit through her brother often, right? So Egypt was where you could really become powerful as a woman. So when Amos honors his grandmother and his mother, he's setting a tradition. You'll see that is going to be really important. See, as we've gone along in history so far, you haven't heard much about queens. Not much about queens of the Middle Kingdom or the Old Kingdom. You will soon. This is where queens become very important. So he honors mother, grandmother. He also makes his wife, who is Queen Amos Nefertari, right? That's her name, Amos Nefertari. He gives his wife a title, and the title is the God's Wife. She is, in a sense, married to the chief god of Egypt, Amun, at this time. Now, Amun, remember, was a hidden one, right? But she's given the title the God's Wife. Now, what that means is she's got a lot of power. She is, in a sense, controlling the temples of Egypt, sort of, because the god isn't around, but she is. Right? Very important. She also has another kind of title almost. She's the heiress. Now, what we mean by that is not that she's going to inherit a lot of stuff. No. What we mean is that she is the one, in a sense, who makes the king what he is. Egypt is a funny place. You know, the king was powerful, but he became king after this 18th dynasty, you'll see exactly how, by marrying the right woman. It was matrilineal. Unlike, say, in England, where they wrote down exactly what the rules were of how you become king, there's no doubt who becomes king in England next. If so-and-so dies, we know so-and-so's next in line, and they've got five, six, seven different possibilities listed. Never any doubt at all. Not so in Egypt. They never wrote down the rules for who becomes king. Now, it's not so surprising. They believed in divine order. So they never wrote down laws in general. There are no books of laws. They had courts. But the feeling was divine order would take its place. So we, Egyptologists, are not 100% sure what the rules were for becoming king. But the main theory, which most of us agree with, is the heiress theory. You became king not by being the king's eldest son. No, didn't automatically do it. You became king by marrying the right woman. And what I mean by the right woman is not the one who's, you know, beautiful and you love her. But the right woman is the one who has the most royal blood flowing through her veins. She is usually the daughter of the king and the queen. Right? So that's the heiress theory. So right off the bat in Dynasty 18, Amos is making women very important. Now, another thing, he goes into Nubia. Now remember, he's kicked out the Hyksos. So he's a military guy. He's used to fighting. And one of the first things he does, he has secured the northern border, right, gotten the Hyksos out of the delta. He goes to Nubia to make sure that the Nubians know he's there. Now, remember when we talked about the Hyksos being expelled? We talked about a military man, Amos, son of Ebana. He's the one who put his autobiography on a wall, and he told about how they kicked out the various, you know, Hyksos. Well, Amos, son of Ebana, lived a long time. And he didn't retire from the military. And he went on many more expeditions. And one of the things he records on the walls of his tomb is going with Amos into Nubia. All right, tell you what he says about going to Nubia. He says, "Now when his majesty had slain the nomads of Asia," Hyksos, right, kicked them out, right, "he sailed south to destroy the Nubian bowmen." Now Nubia was famous for their archers. They were really very, very skilled. And eventually, by the way, the Egyptians sometimes hired them as mercenaries. They had Nubians in their armies, you know, bowmen, a whole corps of bowmen. And Amos, son of Ebana, continues, says, "His majesty made great slaughter among them. I brought spoil from there." Now, that's the thing he's saying. I did well, too. He says, "I brought spoil from there. 2 living men and 3 hands." 3 hands. Now, what does that mean? In ancient Egypt, when you went to war, you wanted to keep tabs of how many people were slain. I mean, they really were a nation of accountants. They listed everything. And they had military scribes with them to list how much spoil was taken, how many captives, how many cattle, and how many killed. But you got a big battlefield. How do you count up how many killed? You know, do you send a scribe running all over the battlefield, counting 3, 4, 5, 6? You know, what do? They cut off the right hands. And they would make a pile in the middle of the battlefield. And then a scribe would come, and he would count the hands. That's how they tallied how many they killed. So when he says, "and he took 3 hands," he's not bringing them back. He says, "he killed 3 people." And then he says, "then I was rewarded with gold once again, and 2 female slaves were given me." So Amos, son of Ebana, you know, as he's tagging along with the pharaohs, his career is doing just fine, just fine. So Amos, the king, sets the tone for a dynasty that's going to do very well. We've got important women. We've got military exploits. It's going fine. Now, his son becomes king, and he's Amenhotep I. Now, remember, names are important. Amenhotep. Amun is the main god of Thebes now, and Hotep means is pleased. So we know that he's trying to please the god Amun. He continues his military, you know, sort of tradition. Dad was a military man, you know. Grandpa was a military man. And he's going to do it. He goes to Nubia also. And you know what's neat is Amos, son of Ebana, our military man, is still alive, and he's going with him to Nubia. And he recorded it. And there's always something different that he's telling you. Listen to this one. He says, this is, again, right off his wall, his autobiography. Says, "His majesty smote the Nubian bowmen in the midst of his army." So in other words, they sort of surrounded them, got the Nubian bowmen, and they're killing them. It says, "they were carried off in fetters, none missing." In other words, they took captives, but nobody got away. Right? And he says, "the fleeing were destroyed as if they had never been." Right? Total decimation. Right? And he tells, of course, "I was given gold, I did very well." Right? He's always sort of adding it on. What's kind of nice is you see a private person rising through the military ranks, he's becoming a person of substance. You know, think about it. He's taking slaves every time he goes on a campaign. He gets two or three slaves. By the end of his career, he's going to have a whole, 30, 40 slaves. He's doing fine. So Amenhotep I is a military man also. But he has an interesting innovation. It's the first king we know of who separates his mortuary temple from his tomb. Let me explain. You're a king. You have plenty of money. And you die. But in ancient Egypt, that doesn't end it. You're going to still go on forever. Now, for some time, your mummy is going to remain in the tomb, though. And you want to make sure that it's got food and everything it needs for the next world. So you paid the ka priests, to come to the tomb and make the offerings. Good. But you often had a little temple next to your tomb, a mortuary temple, a temple for the dead. And there, the ka priest would come and make offerings. He would give bread and beer, food, everything that your soul would need. And he would say prayers for you. And this was a little temple next to your tomb. Amenhotep I separates them. He has a tomb, but his mortuary temple is in a separate place. Now you wonder why. Why does he do this? One possibility is he doesn't want people coming and going from his tomb. It may be too obvious. It may be too much of a target, too easily robbed. So you want people coming and going from your temple, but not from your tomb. But it's something he starts, and as you'll see, it's picked up in a little while in a big way. Now, Amenhotep I, when he died, a successful king, left no sons. The question becomes, who will be king? Right? Well, I can tell you his name, Thutmose I. Now, Thutmose means Toth, the ibis-headed god of writing and knowledge. Toth is born. Moses means born. Right? So Thutmose is Toth is born. He becomes the next king. Now, why? How does he become king? Right? There's no sons. He's not a relative. The answer is he marries the right woman. He marries the daughter of Amos and Queen Amos Nefertari. So he's got a royal woman to marry. That's what makes him king. He's a military man. He's a commoner. Make no bones about it. He's a commoner. But he's a military man who can control the country, probably knew Amenhotep I. He was a warrior king, probably went on the same expeditions. So he marries a king's daughter and becomes a legitimate king of Egypt. That's how he became king. Now, interesting what he does. Like all the other kings, he's going to go to Nubia, beat up the Nubians, make sure he can get the gold. But he goes further than anybody's ever gone. He goes past the fourth cataract. Now, remember, the cataracts are where there are boulders in the Nile. Very, very difficult to navigate. You know, when you went to Nubia, this was the kind of trip that you always remembered for life. This wasn't a little jaunt. This wasn't, oh, let's go with the army for a while. This was a big thing where you could easily lose your life. They usually, when they went to Nubia, would go in May or June. Why? The river was at its lowest. The river's at its lowest. So you can see the boulders and the rocks. You know, you can see the boulders, the rocks, and the river. You can see them clearly. And what they would do is they'd have the army on both sides of the Nile, ropes attached to their boats, and they try to guide the boats up the Nile, around the boulders by pulling and tugging, and hopefully the boats would get by the boulders without being smashed. So they went in May, June, July. May and June is really the months they really went. When the water was at its lowest, but you know, it's also summer. It was 120 degrees sometimes. This was not easy. Often, if there was a full moon, they would try to move the boats, not in the heat of day, but at night, right? Big, big deal to go on an expedition like this. Now, also, when you get that far south, into the fourth cataract where the Nubians are, the river does a strange thing, and it's very disorienting. There's a bend in the river, and the best way I can describe it is like, do you know the pipe that's under your sink in the kitchen that's called an elbow joint, where in order for the water to go down, at some point it's got to go up and then down again? That's what the Nile does, right? It's got that kind of bend in the river, an up and a down. And what that means is, as you're going towards Nubia, at one point, the water seems to be reversing direction. In other words, you're going south against the river, and at some point you're going up the Nile, and at some point the river sort of seems to reverse because you've got that bend in the same way the water under your sink is flowing upwards. And what they called that part of the river, they called it water that turned one who wanted to go north into one who went south. That's what they called it. And it must have been disorienting also if you camped there. Because imagine, you're used to the river flowing one way. When the river flows one way, you know the sun rises on one side, but it's going to be reversed if you're at that little point. It'll seem like the sun's rising on the wrong side of the river. So it was very disorienting. It was a big deal to go to that part of the river. And Thutmose the First went. And you know who went with him? Amos, son of Abana. He was still campaigning. This is his third pharaoh. Right? And he's still going to Nubia. And he left us an account. And this is the last account. He's getting old. You know, he's getting old. It's near his last campaign. He got one more to go. But he says, I was brave in his presence in the bad water, in the towing of the ship over the cataract. Thereupon I was made crew commander. So he's a captain of a ship now. Right? He's rising through the ranks and really doing quite well. Now, Thutmose I does a lot of terrific things. On the Nubian campaign, he conquers two tribes and the sand dwellers. Now, the sand dwellers, they're literally in Egyptian says, those who dwell upon the sand. Those are the Bedouins. There must have been people who lived in the desert. He conquers everybody, right? So I think the reason why Egypt could so easily defeat the Nubians time and time again is that Egypt had that strong central government. They were under a pharaoh. The Nubians were separate tribes. They didn't get their act together. If they'd all joined together, maybe they could have given the Egyptians into battle. But no, they were separate tribes. And we know that Thutmose conquers two tribes and the sand dwellers. And he says, you know, when he's there, way far south, fourth cataract, right? He erects a stela, or round top stone, to commemorate it. And you know what he says? This is Egypt's southern border. Right, so he's claiming everything up to there. And he says, enemies shall have their heads cut off, their families murdered, they will have no successors. Right? So Thutmose is a tough cookie. You know, he really goes pretty far south. And you know what he does when he returns? He takes one of the Nubian leaders and tacks him to the prow of his ship, right, which is called a hawk ship. Right? And it's a couple of weeks' journey back. And this guy's dead, the Nubian leader, upside down. And when he gets back to Thebes, he just sails right into Thebes with this guy upside down, probably rotting by now, on the front of the ship. Everybody's going to know. You don't mess with Thutmose I, right? So he's quite a leader. Now, he's also an innovator. He's not afraid of doing new things. I get the feeling when I read about Thutmose I and I think about him, he's a very strong character, really strong. He even goes north. I mean, north. To Mesopotamia, he goes as far as the Euphrates River. And that's a haul. And that's months of marching and hiking. Right? And he erects a stela, saying, this is Egypt's northern border. So he's really conquering a hell of a lot of territory. I mean, just not afraid at all. But he's got a really important innovation that I want to talk about. He's the first pharaoh to be buried in the Valley of the Kings. First one. You know, we all think of pharaohs being buried in the Valley of the Kings. But they weren't always. He's the first. Now, first, let me say why. Remember our history up until now. We've had a lot of history, and there's a lot to come. But let's talk about the burials of the pharaohs. Let's start with pyramids. Pyramids were large, hulking targets. They were big rob me signs. You know, during an intermediate period, when there was anarchy, nobody protecting the pyramids, they were obvious targets to be robbed. And they were. During the first intermediate period, virtually all the pyramids were robbed. Thutmose knew that. He knew the pyramids had been robbed. During the second intermediate period, when the Hyksos were in charge, many of the pharaoh's tombs were robbed. He knew that. He knew that. The pyramids of the Middle Kingdom kings had been robbed. What do you do? How do you protect your own tomb when you know it's vulnerable? The answer is you hide it. You don't put a big target out there. You bury it and have it as a secret. And that's what Thutmose the First did. Now, let me say something about what he did, how he did it. We have the record of the building of this tomb in the Valley of the Kings. We have his architect's tomb, a man named Ineni. And Ineni talks about building the tomb. And, like Amo, son of Ibana, Ineni was a private person who had a big tomb. He was wealthy. And he put his autobiography on the tomb. Put his autobiography right on it. You know what he says? It's an interesting statement that he makes. He says, you wonder whether you can believe him. He says, I inspected the excavation of the cliff tomb of His Majesty alone. No one seeing, no one hearing. Now, could you really build a tomb that secretly? He says, no one seeing, no one hearing. It was a work of my heart. My virtue was wisdom. There was not given to me a command by an elder. In other words, he wants full credit. It was my idea. Nobody gave me any commands. Right? It was my idea. And then he says, I shall be praised because of my wisdom after years by those who shall imitate what I've done. So he's saying, look, it was my idea. No senior person gave me the idea. I built a tomb. No one seeing, no one hearing. Right? And I'm going to be praised, and people are going to follow my example. Now, the Valley of the Kings is on the west bank of Thebes. It's opposite many of those famous temples that you see. Remember that the Egyptians lived on the east bank of the Nile, but associated the west with the dead, because the sun died in the west every day and was reborn in the east. So, generally, the west was used for burials. Generally. So, naturally, the Valley of the Kings is on the west bank of the Nile. And when Thutmose' architect, Ineni, started building his tomb, it was absolutely barren. One of the things that still gets tourists when they go to the Valley of the Kings, nothing grows there. There's nothing there. It is absolutely barren. It is, the humidity there, it averages about 18. You know what? We're not used to numbers like that for humidity. But about 18 is the humidity. It's dry. Nothing grows there. And that's why Ineni picked it. I mean, Ineni, this sharp-eyed architect, he knew. He didn't want a place that later people were going to have settlements. People were going to build their houses, grow crops. No. He picked the most barren, desolate spot he could find. Now, not only that, it's in a valley. It's called the Valley of the Kings now. Thutmose I was the first king built, buried there. It's called, in Arabic, by the way, it's Wadi al-Maluk. Wadi means a riverbed. It's a dry riverbed, so to speak. Al-Maluk, of the kings. Right? It's the dry riverbed of the kings. The other virtue of this spot, and there are two other virtues, actually. Another virtue of the spot is that it only has one entrance, a narrow passageway, so you could guard it. You put a couple of guards there, nobody else is going to get by. That's one virtue. But another virtue is, and I wonder if they must have thought about this when they picked it. At the very top of the cliffs, and they're high cliffs, 100 feet high, more, is a natural pyramid. You look up, you can't miss it. It's a natural pyramid. Kind of, again, hearkening back to the good old days of the pharaohs of the old kingdom. Now, this claim that, and then he built it, no one seeing, no one hearing. There's been a lot of discussion about that. Is it possible, is it even possible to build a tomb like that with no one hearing, no one seeing? I don't think so. I really don't. One suggestion has been that foreign captives, built the tomb, and then they were killed so that no one would know. It's possible. I think it's also possible that it was probably, done quietly. Don't talk where you're working or you're in trouble. And it is a very desolate spot. Nobody's going to walk by and see lots of workmen easily. So I think it's possible. Just possible that it was kept quiet, but this is the first tomb in the Valley of the Kings. Now, it's an interesting thing to see how a tomb is constructed. in the Valley of the Kings. The Valley of the Kings is made primarily, and this is going to hold for all the other tombs in the Valley of the Kings. The Valley of the Kings is basically limestone, white limestone. And almost all the tombs, and you know, please remember that after this point, nobody's going to be buried in a pyramid. You know, so a lot of people think, say, that Tutankhamun, when they found the treasures, he was buried in a pyramid. No way. He's buried in a tomb in the Valley of the Kings. And the tombs are constructed by chiseling into the white limestone. Remember, you have cliffs on both sides. So you can dig tunnels. Now, usually, the tunnels go underground. It's a descending passageway, usually. 100 feet, more, 200 feet, even more in some tombs, going down beneath the bedrock. Beneath bedrock. And then you can construct a burial chamber. Now, there's a reason why the Valley of the Kings is perfect for this. Limestone is soft. It's a soft stone, and it flakes. So you can chisel away with your soft chisels. They don't have iron. They don't have steel. They've got copper chisels, you know. They have bronze, but not really hard. But you can chisel away fairly easily. And that's why they picked the Valley of the Kings. And there's another virtue of that. White limestone has nice, smooth surfaces. You can polish it and paint it and have beautifully decorated tombs. So I think that's another reason why Ineni, this sharp-eyed architect, picks the Valley of the Kings. So Thutmose I, not afraid, buries himself in a place that nobody's ever been buried before. An innovator. What else does he do? He also erects a pair of obelisks at Karnak Temple. Now, we're going to do a whole lecture on obelisks. They're wonderful things, obelisks. Wonderful. But he erects the largest obelisk ever erected up until that time, a pair of them, at Karnak Temple in Thebes. Now, Karnak Temple is beginning to become important because the kings of the 18th dynasty are establishing Thebes as the religious center. And what does Thutmose I do? He goes to Karnak and he erects two obelisks. Obelisks almost always come in pairs, right? And they don't do much, obelisks. They're not functional. But they give the pharaoh a place to put his glory. He has an inscription going up and down and he tells how great he is, right? So he erects two obelisks in Karnak Temple praising the god Amun. Amun is going to be the most important god in Thebes. And remember how Amun started off? Do you remember very far back to about lecture 3 or so? We talked about in the primordial waters were 8 gods. Right? Remember, there were formlessness, darkness, the waters themselves, and hiddenness. That was Amun. Amun is always going to be referred to as the hidden one now. He is a god who is hidden. He doesn't really interact very easily with the people, but he's a hidden one. So Thutmose I is really quite a character. Going to Nubia, going north to Mesopotamia, first Valley of the King's tomb, really an innovator. But there's going to be a slight problem. Thutmose I, as far as we know, had 3 sons and 2 daughters. Right? Now, remember that a pharaoh could have many wives. But a pharaoh only had 1 great wife, right? She was the honcho of the harem. She was the one who took precedence. She is the queen. There is no word, by the way, in ancient Egyptian for queen. There's no word. What we translate as queen is great wife. And Thutmose I, as far as we know, only has these 5 kids by the great wife. It's got sons, 3, daughters too. But by the time he dies, all of his sons are dead. There is no one to succeed him as a clear-cut king. There is only 1 purely royal kid alive when Thutmose I dies. 1 of his daughters. He had a young daughter. Her older sister died. The daughter's name is Hatshepsut. She is 12 years old and the only royal child alive. The question is, who will become the next king? And we'll talk about that next time. See you then.